Today is Sunday, October 11th, 2020. This is our Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Richard Hanson, H-A-N-S-O-N. And my name is Tom Martin. This is a part two interview. Hey, good morning, Richard. How are you today?
I'm doing good, thank you.
Good. Glad to hear it. May we have your permission to record this interview over the telephone?
Yes, you can.
Thank you. We wrapped up our first interview. You had returned from your tour of duty in Vietnam, had just seen so much over there, discrimination and just a number of things. Can you pick that thread up from there after you returned to the States?
Sure. I just grabbed a hold of my discharge so I could get the dates a little closer, you know. I mean, it's been a long time ago.
Yeah.
So, it doesn't have the day that I got back from Vietnam, but I spent a total of 1 year, 7 months, and 2 days in Vietnam. And I think I got back sometime in March of 1969. I still had 7 or 8 months to do in the military. I came back a drug addict and a stoner. And I knew that in the current situation, that was going to be trouble.
Okay.
I was coming back from a place where basically you did what you pleased. You grew your hair how you wanted to do it. You didn't shine your boots. You didn't do any of that kind of stuff to them. To be attached to a military hospital as the back seat in an ambulance crew. And so I knew that it was going to be kind of a difficult transition. And I came back about as anti-war as you could get. And that was still early. 69 was still early to be coming out against the war, if you were a veteran. The Vietnam veterans against the war that Kerry and the boys basically founded back east, I think might have been founded in 69, because I joined the organization. But after I got back, I had 30 days before I had to report to my new duty station, and I alternated between anti-war rallies, San Francisco mostly, and Berkeley, Oakland, and then taking days and days at a time at Yosemite. And I reported for duty at Mather and Sacramento. I think it had to have been sometime in April of 1969. And it was immediately I don't know how to say it. The feelings that I had about reporting to this place were, I think, was kind of like maybe a gay guy not being able to come out, you know? I mean, this was the last thing I wanted to do. It wasn't who I was. I was hiding my true feelings. And by that time, I was mostly drug-free, except for, you know, I've smoked pot all my life and still smoke pot.
Uh-huh.
But I haven't done any hard drugs in, well, shoot, 50-some-odd years, you know. I mean, some psychedelics and some mushrooms and some pot, basically. But I lasted about 3 weeks to a month. I came to work one day, and it was real weird. I mean, it was like, okay, and I had made sergeant, and so that meant that I could live off base, which was nice. I made it my last few months in Vietnam, stoned as I was. Mm-hmm. I was still able to pull off the deal, and I remember. And I might have been there a month at Mather. Coming to work one day after a weekend of Fillmore Auditorium, street fighting and protesting. And my commanding officer looked at me, and I was not ready to. I didn't have the look, you know. I had sideburns, I was growing those out, and my shoes were dirty, and yada, yada, yada. And he said to me, Sergeant Hanson, you get out of here and don't come back until you look like a soldier. And so I left, and I didn't come back. That's when I went AWOL. And during that AWOL period, I again headed up to Yosemite and San Francisco, Yosemite, San Francisco, Yosemite, San Francisco, until I got busted. And there was also, I don't know when People's Park. I got arrested at People's Park. I was one of the first ones. I was still in the military. We got thrown in the Alameda County Jail. And that might have been, I don't know what month it was. But anyway, I was basically, like I say, man, I was in turmoil. I wasn't able to live the life that I wanted to. Or that I knew I should be living.
Right.
It was, like I say, it was the closest I could get is being gay and not being able to come out of the closet, or being trans and not being able to come out of the closet. I wasn't able to come out of the closet. To a certain degree, I was. I drove a 1955 pink Cadillac adorned with anti-war stuff. That didn't go over well on Mather.
When you went to Yosemite, what did you see there? What attracted you there? That, you know, I can appreciate when there's an action happening on the street, anti-war action, you're going to want to be there. But between times, you didn't head to a library to read. I mean, it sounds like you took solace in the Sierras.
Oh, that's exactly right. You know, they were the healing influence on my life. It was the peace and quiet. It was the nature would just, you know, wash all over me. It was the physical activity of just being able to get out and I wasn't a climber. I did a lot of bouldering, but just now it was pretty. It saved my life, you know.
Yeah.
Wilderness basically saved my life. I had a place to go where I felt at peace and I could I could do basically and feel how I wanted to feel. And when I was in the city on those days where there were rallies in Fillmore and Avalon and Winterland and Grateful Dead and everybody else who ever played a guitar, it was the acid in the pot. And the, you know, getting high. So no, Yosemite was set the pace for, you know, the next 50 years of my life. I live here in Hawaii. I have a house with no walls. You know, don't fence me in.
Nice.
So we're at 69 some month. I was looking at my deal. So yeah, it was probably June, July. My lost time on my discharge went from June to October, which means that's when I was AWOL and then busted and then in jail.
So June, July, August, September.
Yeah, half the time was been AWOL, and about half the time would have been jail.
I don't mean to be flippant, but couldn't you make an argument that said my commanding officer told me to leave?
Yeah.
Until I was ready to come back, and I wasn't ready.
Yeah, and I think we broached that, but the I also looked at my psychiatric evaluations that I had to have done before trial.
Okay.
And I don't know, I could read you some of that shit if you actually really wanted to.
No,
hear it,
no, I don't.
Yeah. So basically, my lawyer decided the best way for me was him to just ask me why I left. And that's when I spent 2.5-3 hours spieling my anti-war. What I had seen, why I couldn't continue being a military guy. And it got a little press, because I'd say it was early to have somebody court-martialed for being against the war and stuff, and that had an adverse impact that my father, who I hadn't been really talking to at all, saw that I was being court-martialed for AWOL desertion. And we didn't talk again for quite some time. He basically disowned me. So when I got out of jail, this would be October of 1969, I still had all the time. My last time didn't count towards my enlistment, but every day I was in jail, and I didn't know that until I got out.
So when you were in jail, it didn't count, or it did count?
Yeah, it did not.
Did not count. Okay.
So I basically still had the same amount of months as when I went in there. And when I got out, I was a friggin' mess, man. I was a mess, and it played out that the doctors and such that I was working with were mostly draftees. The psychiatrist I'd been seeing, he was also a draftee, and I had to see him to see if I was fit to stand trial, and I know right from wrong, and you know all this other stuff. So I stood trial, but my commanding officer was a lifer. My first sergeant was a lifer, and the first thing they said to me when I got out was, "Hanson, And when I got out, I was back to an E-1. I lost my sergeant stripe, and I was an airman basic.
Okay.
I was like, all right, went in an E-1 and got out an E-1. They said to me, Hanson, you know, you still got 6-7 months to go. And they said, you know, we know you're going to fuck up again, and we're going to be watching you every fucking step of the way. And the next time, it's not going to be 2 months in a friggin' jail. It's going to be 11 worth. And we're just, you know, and they're smiling the whole time. They're telling me this shit, you know.
Uh-huh.
And that would have been on the 5th or 6th of October. And I soldiered through for a couple of weeks, and I was talking to this doctor friend of mine. I was just telling him, bro, man, I'm not going to be able to do this. I can't fucking. And they're going, well, you only got 6 or 7 months, man. You got to do it. And I said, man, fuck, I'm not going to be able to do it.
What did they have you doing for those 2 weeks? I mean, you're back to an E1. What kind of stuff were you doing?
I was answering the phone at the friggin' base hospital.
Okay.
I had been taken off the ambulance crew, and I wasn't doing a very good job answering the phone either. I got a call one day, bro. You don't know who's calling, you know, but it's a lady, and she's going, well, yeah, I need to talk to somebody. She says, my vagina really itches, and I just said, scratch it, and hung up, and turned out it was some officer's wife, you know, and so I didn't get in big trouble. I think I got an Article 15 for that one. But these doctors are, and the psychiatrist says, let's set up a meeting with the commanding officer and your first sergeant and just see how we can make this shit go away, and you can do your 5 or 6 months without fucking going to prison or without going to Canada, because they really liked me. And I'd done my time in Nam, and I'd done a really good job there. And I said, I'd be willing to do that. And this is sometime the first week of November when we're having this meeting. Yeah, because I got discharged, I think. So anyway, we're going to have this meeting. And so we go into, I think it was a little corner of the mess hall. And there was 12 or 13 of us there, mostly doctors showing support for me. You know, a couple of career guys, the commanding officer, the first sergeant, and one or two other career guys, and two psychiatrists. And they started talking about how I was going to have to do this, or this was going to happen, and the doctors would come in and go, well, how about if he did that? And the other guys would go, no, he's going to have to do this. And I think I listened for about 10 minutes, and I had a nervous breakdown right there. I just stood up, and I started bawling. I mean, just fucking bawling. And pointing my fingers at these guys and going, I'm not the one fucked up. You're the one fucked up. I just went out and just screaming, and then I started picking up the folding chairs and tossing them and shit, you know. And an MP was right there. And 10 minutes after I started my little rant, I was back in jail. And 2 days later, one of my doctor friends comes in, and he goes, "Let's go, you're out." I said, "I don't want to go out." I said, I really don't want to go out, man. I'm not going back out there." And no, he said, "No, you're out of the military." And I said, "What?" He says, "You're out of the military." And so it turns out that the psychiatrists and the doctors in there had saw something real. And I was given a mental discharge. I was a passive-aggressive schizophrenic, and my court-martial diagnosis that I knew right from wrong and all that, my diagnosis was adult situational disorder. Got to laugh at that, man, you know. Having trouble finding my place. Well, duh. Adult situational disorder, you know,
yeah.
Fuck.
Yeah.
And, you know, 3 months later, I had graduated to passive-aggressive schizophrenic. And...
So the medical discharge, were you able to keep any of your military benefits with regards to health care?
The answer is yes. I could have bought a house, I guess, on the GI Bill. I could have gone to college on the GI Bill. But I chose to have absolutely nothing to do with them.
Okay.
I mean, for forever.
Yeah. No, makes sense. I'm just thinking. Wow, that, you know, that's a medical discharge. You know, is not exactly what was going on. But the military had no way to accommodate what was happening. And you know, I'm assuming that as the decades went by, they got that figured out. But you know, were you stripped of all that was due to you for the service that you rendered to the country?
Not all of it. I don't think I can have a flag on my coffin. Like I say, man, I haven't dealt with them. I saw the way my brother, for 15 years, he was 100% disabled vet. And he was the same as me, basically. He was, he'd been wounded, but his was all PTSD.
Yeah.
I think they coined the phrase PTSD in the mid-70s. I'm not sure. But they didn't have anything for us. But I saw how getting that monthly check, made in VA health care and, you know, all the stuff that comes along with being 100% disabled actually keeps you from having any drive.
Right.
Yes.
It can be a trap.
It's a trap. Yeah. And don't get me wrong, my brother had a really nice life, and he did volunteer, and he did stuff, but he lived very simply. So, and you know, 100%, I don't know what he was getting a month, but it was enough to get by and to have some beer money.
Mm-hmm.
So I never wanted to go there.
Right.
never really had, never wanted to go in the office and fill out the papers. Never, I mean, people, you know, shit, 8 or 10 years after were telling me, man, you could go get on disability, you know, with this discharge. You know, it's right here. You're a passive aggressive schizophrenic, man. We changed the name to fucking PTSD. And, I'm going, you know, I don't even want to deal with that. I don't even want to walk in the office.
Right.
So I got out sometime in November of 69. And I remember going, the night I got out, going to a Dead concert. They were playing in Sacramento for benefit for KFAT. And I went back to Berkeley. And Altamont was happening in a few days.
Remind me what that is.
Altamont was the free concert by the Rolling Stones and the Grateful Dead at the Altamont Speedway.
Okay.
Right outside the city. And I should have Googled the dates of Altamont, but this is my memory. It happened, but I don't know the exact dates. And went to Altamont, and it was a friggin'... A great movie about Altamont is Helter Skelter.
Oh, okay.
I ate 2 hits of purple mescaline, and about 45 minutes after I ate them, Wavy Gravy got up on the deal and said, please don't take any of the purple mescaline. We're having a lot of bad trips at the aid tent.
Oops.
Anyway, yeah, that's what I said. I said, those are my exact words. Kind of oops, and I was just coming on to him. And I said I had enough sense to move to the back and just sit up on a hill. And it wasn't bad, you know, it wasn't bad. And after that, winter was coming. I made my first sojourn down to Mexico, hitchhiked from Berkeley, had a little sign right on the telegraph said Mexico. Some guy friggin' picked me up, drove me all the way to San Diego, and crossed the border. Found a little spot about 1,000 miles down called Playa Los Cocos, and I was, you know, by myself, and I was getting better. I was healing. I got a little palapa, a little thatched roof place at the end of the beach.
So this is down in the jungle. If you're 1,000 miles down, it was
south of Mazatlan, about 200 miles. So maybe it was. Yeah, I mean, it was jungly. It was in the province of Topeka.
Okay.
Tampico. Tampico, Topeka. Topeka is the city.
Okay.
Topeka. It was Playa Los Cocos. The nearest little town was San Blas.
Okay.
And I bought a 20-dollar surfboard, and I was there for about a month. There was hardly anybody on the beach, and the palapa about 100 yards down from me all of a sudden had 5 people staying in it. And I went over, introduced myself, and there were 5 gay people from San Francisco.
Huh.
2 guys and 3 girls. Some of the nicest people. Some of the finest people I'd ever hung out with.
Nice.
And yeah, I ended up falling in love with one of the girls. We ended up traveling together and hanging out for 4 or 5 years. Never slept with her. We slept, but we never made love.
Mm-hmm.
And I started on the on the road to recovery that winter of 69 and early 70. And yeah, and then things started getting interesting from like 1970 when I was out of the military to about 1980 when I think it was late 79 when I took the foreman's job at Grand Canyon. But those 9 years were, those are the ones that blow my mind. You know, I tell people that I wouldn't wish the first 25 years, 24 years of my life on anybody. I just, you know, with the home life and then the war and then the after effects of the war, fighting, I still was fighting the demonstrations, man, I was just so good at, you know, I mean, I felt a sense of liberation. And I could make a gas mask on the fly and pick up the tear gas canister and throw it back at him, and I was good, and the liberation part, man, was like finally I'm doing something that I believe in after years of not. And it was probably, again, the only reference I can make is probably like a gay guy coming out after a whole lot of years and just going, hallelujah.
What was the name of the woman that you met?
Catherine Hauser. I loved this friggin'. She was from Santa Rosa, California. I would love to find her again. I think her last name was Hauser. I've tried Googling her and stuff, but I don't really know the keywords and how to do that shit.
Yeah. So from Mexico, did you stay in Mexico with her, or did you head back to California with her, back to San Francisco?
A little of both. We stayed down there for, I think, until about April or May.
Probably a six-month tourist visa?
Yeah, maybe we were there. Maybe from like the end of November to, I'd say April was probably, because then the mountains started calling. And so we went back to the city, and a couple of the people had really nice places there. And for the next few years, that pattern held. It was Yosemite and San Francisco in the spring and summer. South America and Mexico in the winters.
Huh.
And that, you know, I got by in Yosemite by, you know, selling bags to climbers, doing Sherpa work on some of the big climbs, being a Sherpa. And that's basically the time frame, too, over those few years where I met my first mule.
And okay.
That just friggin' turned my life around there.
Before you tell me that story, because I'm going to want that story, I'm trying to place this in time with the Yosemite riots.
The Yosemite riots were my last, basically, the Stoneman Meadow riots.
Yeah.
Were my last, basic, my last riot. And I think that would have been 72. I'm not sure. It's one I remember. I could Google that. I think it was 72, because it hadn't happened yet. I had a couple of good years up there before the riots.
And you hadn't met, you hadn't had your interaction with the mule yet. I'm just trying to put this into timeline. Is that right?
I had my first interactions with the mules. It would have been the spring of 1970.
Okay.
Sometime in the spring of 1970.
And how did that happen?
Well, the Park Service at that time, you know, since then they've moved everything to El Portal and such, but had their corrals up by the Awani, set up against a cliff where I used to go bouldering and stuff, right in the valley. And the first time I went over there, you know, they're sticking their heads over the fence and stuff, you know. And you go over there and rub their nose. Never, I don't remember seeing a friggin' mule before. And I pet them, scratch their ears, and they would just do what mules do. Just smile at you, I say, when they're, you know, got their lips all curled up and their teeth showing. And they'd kick each other. I'd go over to the Awani and I'd clear out every fucking sugar cube from the table. And give them sugar cubes. And I got to the point where just about every day I was in the valley, I would go over and hang with the mules. And then I met a packer, or the animal caretaker, one of the animal packers for Yosemite. He was,
do you remember his name?
Sweet Pea is all I knew him by. And he was, I guess, you know, I don't know if he's still alive. I met other people from Yosemite through the years after I got hooked up with the Park Service. Oh, yeah, Sweet Pea's still there. He probably wouldn't remember me. We probably talked a total of, you know, he was a cowboy, you know. They just don't talk, you know, much, but mind if I feed the mules? Go ahead, you know. Mind if I give them sugar? No. And I would watch him pack them if he was heading out. Sometimes I'd watch him shoe them. And I just went, man, that looks like fun. And so that was my first exposure to mules. And I was getting to know the backcountry real well, and I came up on this fucking cabin, Snow Creek Cabin. I was basically lost. I was cross-country hiking. It was about 7 miles out of the valley floor. Go up Snow Creek Trail, but kind of by Mirror Lake.
Okay.
And I'm just cross-countrying, man, and I come across this friggin' cabin, you know, all dilapidated. And I go in the door and stuff, and I'm looking around, and there's some newspapers and such there. There's a potbelly stove, and there's a nice cook stove in the little kitchen area, wood cook stove, and all the newspapers were about Bonnie and Clyde.
Whoa.
I know, bro. And I went, fuck. So Cliff Notes version. I ended up kind of fixing the place up. And it was my home away from the valley, home away from San Francisco. I could spend weeks up there. Catherine was with me a lot of the time. And we packed in, I think it was 23 bundles of cedar shake and put a new roof on it. Cleaned out this spring. that was next to it, because before you had to go down Snow Creek to get water, which was about a half mile away. It had this little spring in a meadow, you know, in the middle of Yosemite National Park.
Right? Wow. And somehow it had fallen off the park's radar screen, if it had ever been on the park's radar screen.
Yep. Yep. Came to find out that it was built by the Curry Company.
Wow.
Or some of the Curries or some of the big guys to have a place to lodge back in the 20s and 30s if they were out cross-country skiing and such.
Huh.
And then, but I think it must have been abandoned right in the mid-30s, because I think that was Bonnie and Clyde time. That's what I remember looking at the papers.
Hmm.
Was, so, that was, I found that place, I think, in the summer of 1970. And like I say, fixed it up a little bit, and it was just this, it was like an ashram or something, man. It was like a healing place, you know.
Like a refuge.
Yeah, it was amazing. Because when I was in the valley, I found a little cave next to Camp 4, and it was up off the floor of the campground, just a ways up, and put a little rock wall in front of it, and I would stay there, my little cave. And then this place was Snow Creek. The Snow Creek cabin was just, you know, just, I don't know, man, just wonderful. Just wonderful.
Did you have any relationship with any of the Park Service personnel at this time outside of Sweet Pea?
No.
Okay.
No. You know, Park Service, was, rangers and stuff. I didn't know anything about trail crews and, you know, this kind of stuff and that kind of stuff. I'd see the rangers coming in, patrolling the campground, and I'd see this and that, but no. And there was a heavy emphasis on law enforcement in those days, and actually in a lot of the days, rangers were cops.
Mm-hmm.
No, I didn't.
Okay.
And I'm thinking it's 72. Might have been 73. I definitely did. But that's another story. I went on for a couple of years, disappearing from Yosemite and going down south. And then I would come back, and my revolutionary tendencies were starting to wane a little bit. You know, they were mostly peaceful, but there was some that were violent, and it wasn't doing me a lot of good to be around violence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I could come back from those feeling, like I said, semi-euphoric, just because, okay, man, I'm fighting for what I believe in, and, you know, and this, but, you know, that thrill would wear off, where when I was in Yosemite, there was a long period of calmness.
Nice.
And I came to appreciate that more than I, and, you know, by that time, 71, 70, 71, 72, I felt that basically I'd paid my dues. So, yeah. That was that's my mule story. That's how I... And that's what I was telling you the other day. If you had told me back then that 8 or 10 years later I'd be the friggin' trail foreman in charge of all the mules, government mules in the park and all the trails in the park, I'd have said, you know, you're crazy. You know, there's absolutely no way. And but that's an interesting, it's an interesting part of my life is when after that I did make that connection at the Yosemite Corrals and made the connection with animal I just absolutely love. I would talk more to them than I would talk to any person.
Nice.
Having been in my life for 30, 35 years has just been, you know, pretty fucking incredible.
Nice.
So I guess, you know, we're probably at a point we could pick it up later.
That sounds good, yeah, because I would like to know about Stoneman, what happened there. And,
well, Stoneman, do you know how to Google and talk on the phone?
I do, except that where I do the recording is in another room where the computer's over across the house, and, because I...
Well, I was just going to ask you if you could Google dates on Stoneman.
I can do that. After the call, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And you worked at Grand Canyon, so you probably knew Jim Wergler.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim and I did a wonderful series of oral histories. He talked about his experience there at Stoneman, his take on it. And so that
and
was...
And also, the man leading the charge at Stoneman Meadows was... Dick Marks.
Who became superintendent at Grand Canyon.
Grand Canyon, when I was there, and who happened to hear that I'd been at the meadow, because, and I don't know how he heard. I think it was because I went into Albright, and I had heard that they had probably one of the last copies of David Vassar's film on the meadows, and I asked if I could look at it.
Huh?
They gave me a private deal and private screening. And a couple years later, I ended up actually doing a film with David Vassar, and we talked a lot about it. He was the director on the Paul Winter concerts, River Trips, when they were making the album Canyon, and they also did a film called Canyon Consort or something. I don't know if you've seen it or heard of it,
yeah.
But yeah, actually it was a wonderful film. I've just watched it and I was on all four of those River Trips, and so I got to know David pretty well and a couple other people, but anyway.
Well, we're getting ahead of ourselves, and we got a lot of neat things to talk about, so my tail is wagging. this sounds great. Maybe this is a good time to wrap up part two, and we'll pick it back up. I'll look up the dates for Stoneman.
Yeah, I can too, I think it's 1972, because I think I pulled out of Yosemite in 73 or 74.
Okay. So we'll pick that up, and we'll go through that, and we'll slowly work our way to when you do cycle back around to the Park Service.
All right, then we got another 8 years to go, bro.
That's right, and I'm not in a hurry. This is great. Well, with that. We'll conclude part two, our Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Richard Hansen. My name is Tom Martin, and today is Sunday, October 11th, 2020. Richard, thank you so very much.
Hey, thanks, man. Feels good talking to somebody.